Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been in the front lines of that war for decades in a variety of capacities, but most especially in his role as the founding president of the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, D.C., is our guest. His name is Herman Pirchner. He has had extensive experience in some of the most challenging places in the world, notably the Russian Federation and the China of the Chinese Communist Party. He's also spent a lot of time and focused energy on some of the areas that had previously been enslaved by the Soviets, notably Ukraine. And we're going to talk with him about his insights drawing on all of those experiences and what they should dictate in terms of both our understanding of the challenges we're facing at the moment, notably in Ukraine, but more broadly from these bad actors. Herman Pirchner, it's good to have you back. It's been far too long, and we're delighted to have a chance to visit with you at some length about the challenges that we're facing at the moment, notably from the invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin. But more broadly, what is he up to, and where do we go from here? Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here with you and continue our discussions. I think probably our first discussions when we were both Senate staff in the early 1980s. So hard to believe so much time.
Well, a lot of hard experience in the course of it all. So, Herman, let's set the stage for this conversation by talking a little bit about the trips that you have been making now for, I don't know, a decade or two, I guess, to places like the Kremlin and
our first trip to the Soviet Union was 89, just as it was coming unglued. And, of course, my history, as you know, is with anti-communist activities within foreign policy. I've been more than 70 times to Russia, Ukraine, or Kazakhstan, other parts of the former Soviet Union, and know it pretty well. When Putin was first coming to power, you would ask about him to people that knew him or observed him coming up, not necessarily allies, of course. And the constant was he only talked about money and raw power and that he was an extremely good liar. I was told not even sophisticated Russians can tell when he's spinning them and making use of them. And I think that has continued today. He's suckered a lot of people in with his talk, even though everybody knows that he lies. They think he can't lie to me because I'm such a great statesman, I can see through it. And that's invited a great amount of miscalculation in the United States and Western Europe.
I'm reminded in that regard, of course, of George W. Bush's famous comment about how he had looked into his eyes and seen his soul. What did you make of that comment? And how does that fit that, you know, sort of paradigm you just talked about?
When I heard that, I certainly understood Putin didn't believe it. And I hope that Bush didn't believe it when he said it, too. But I'm not so sure. But Bush did a lot better than some in dealing with Russia. And I'm reminded that for their own reasons, Russia did offer some help after 9/11 in Afghanistan with maps letting us know where the caves were, where minefields were, and so forth.
But Herman, you've seen over the years that you've been traveling there and your contacts with people at all levels, I guess, of sort of the hierarchy, the power structure there, an opportunity has been afforded you to sort of trace the trajectory of this fellow, Vladimir Putin, how he came to power, how he consolidated power, the kind of, well, I think of it as a sort of chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization that he did after the fall of the Soviet Union, which he, as you know, declared to be the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. Give us a sense of that trajectory and the evolution of the man as you've seen it over the years.
He is a KGB agent, was stationed in East Germany, and had to, as part of that job, understand everything about German history. And if you look at how he consolidated power, it bears some semblance to how Hitler consolidated power, and some of his foreign policy now that Russia is stronger also bears a lot of resemblance to that. Now, what do I mean? That means he began by capturing institutions. When he came to power, he wasn't in that strong a position because there were other power centers with governors and people in control of the army that were not necessarily Putin people, because in the Soviet Union, the army and the KGB were rivals.
Well, there was Boris Yeltsin, for starters. How did he relate to Yeltsin, and how did he ultimately come to supplant him?
That's a great story, and I had an insider tell me about that. It was down to Putin and one other person that had moderate democratic instincts. And Yeltsin was under attack, and he asked both of them to go on TV and radio to defend Yeltsin. Putin was more vigorous in his defense, and that's how he was picked. But it wasn't inevitable that he was going to come to power. But when he came to power, by killing people, by fooling people, he gradually created a one-party state, and that party is the KGB. It's hard to find anybody in senior positions in Russia that doesn't have an intel background from that organization. At least your father was in it, if you
Among the people that he killed, of course, in large numbers back in the day, and I understand, correct me if I'm wrong about this, Herman Pirchner, that it was instrumental in his rise to power, was Chechnya. Talk about what he did there, and it'll have some bearing on what he's up to now. And
yeah, he helped consolidate his power by creating a pretext to launch a second Chechen war. There's substantial evidence that he, with his most brutal operatives, actually bombed some apartment buildings in Moscow, killing Russian citizens, and blamed it on the Chechens. Those bombings stopped when some KGB operatives were caught putting what looked like explosives in the basement of yet another apartment building. And they blew that off saying, well, we were just doing a drill to see how it might have happened.
Caught red-handed, I think, is the term for it.
Yes, good choice of adjectives.
So in Moscow, he was creating this provocation for a new war. And then how did he prosecute that war, Herman, in Chechnya, which is, of course, a Muslim populated part of the former Soviet Union, and was deemed by him to be a terrorist threat, witness these bombings that he may have orchestrated himself in Moscow?
He had a general problem that, and it still exists today, that the Northern Caucasus, which are Muslims, want to break from Russia. There are other parts of Russia that want to break from Moscow too. So he finally decided to suppress it through brutality, and he reduced the capital city of Chechnya, Grozny, to rubble. And when there was no city there, and they killed and tortured a lot of people, the resistance collapsed, and he finally found a Chechen warlord, Kadyrov, that would run the place, being subservient to Putin, and that's the condition today. Kadyrov has pledged to send Chechen fighters to Moscow to help Putin if ever necessary.
And in the process of all this, Herman, he did consolidate power in Moscow as well, and among others, through the use of these so-called power ministries controlled by his KGB cohort, right?
Power is kept in Russia by the gun, and he put his colleagues and head of the intelligence services and head of the National Guard, every organization that had any guns. And he got them to be loyal by enriching them. The usual deal was there would be, say, a budget for the Olympics, and 50% would be skimmed off the top and spread around Putin's colleagues. And with, of course, some going to Putin.
Yeah, and the process, on that point, Herman, I am told, is the richest man in the world. Would you credit that?
I think it's entirely possible. He's put a lot of, most of it in other people's names, but if he asked it to be spent a certain way, it just happened.
And some percentage of that has presumably been frozen now as a result of the Ukraine caper. But it's just a stunning indictment, really, that this kleptocracy and, you know, its underpinnings in the KGB has created this one-man rule, one-party rule, you say, for decades now. And this brings us up to the present moment, I think, Herman, which is a man who has long believed that NATO and the United States particularly had been responsible for the greatest catastrophe in the 20th century, namely the fall of the Soviet Union, has been, it seems, set on getting even. So it's part of the context, isn't it, of how he views the possibility that Ukraine might become part of NATO. Walk us through sort of that background to this current crisis.
Putin and the circle around him are imperialist, and they believe the state has greatness if it expands its territory by the use of force. One of his top aides, a guy by the name of Surkov, Vladislav, wrote an article about Putinism in 2019, and it was meant entirely for a Russian audience. It was not circulated by Russia anywhere outside of Russia. But let me read from just a small part of it. It says, Russia has regained its innate status of a great power. It's growing in size and assembling land inhabited by people linked by a common heritage. And by the way, that could include Poland. This starring role was assigned to our country by world history. I mean, basically what he means is Russian expansionism and imperial activity are simply a matter of historical destiny. And they don't care how their people live. While Putin and his cronies have all become multi-billionaires, not millionaires, billionaires, if you travel in Russia, you find hospitals without hot water. You find the most horrid conditions among the average person on basic things like health. But they don't care because everybody's supposed to serve the state. And if the common person has to suffer, it's too bad. As long as the state is strong, which means Putin is strong and they can loot, everything's
good.
Can I
just clarify something about the ideology here, Herman Pirchner? Would you characterize Putin as a communist? Is he a fascist? Okay. And so everything is in the service of the state, meaning him. And as you say, the sort of raping and pillaging that has taken place over these many years has sort of teed up a policy towards the so-called near abroad. And as you've mentioned, you've spent a lot of time traveling in those areas, Ukraine prominent among them. Give us a sense, if you would, Herman, of how Putin and his cadre of imperialists have regarded these former Soviet republics, including, of course, Ukraine.
Well, there's an idea, first off, of a greater Slavic state, which would include Belarus, Ukraine, and northern Kazakhstan, which has a substantial Slavic population. But I think that the Poles are right to worry, too. You know, they remember Russian invasion 1772, 1793, 1795, when Poland disappeared from the map. They remember additional Russian invasions 1920, and of course, World War II started in 1939 when Nazi Germany and then Allied Soviet Union both attacked Poland. So they have territorial ambitions. And I'd like to go back to the point you made about everything subordinated to the state. Going back to Surkov, because it's such a clear explanation. Various branches of power are linked to the personality of the leader, jointly or severally, and they have no value in and of themselves, but only to the extent that they're connected to the leader. So that means, the Russian Orthodox Church may be good for putting the Putin message out to the Kremlin, and that the leadership is completely subservient to the Kremlin. But if ever it's a conflict between God and the state represented by Putin, Putin wins all the time, and the church has to back down.
So this is really an important insight, because we're often told that Putin can be relied upon by the West because he is an Orthodox Christian and has, brought back the church and is very much a defender of it, particularly against, Sharia supremacism and other threats. Is that your view, Herman Percher?
He's a defender of Russian Orthodox Church because the church is subservient to him. He's helped the leadership enrich themselves, and they exist because they serve a political end. I can't think of a group of less Christian individuals than those surrounding Putin. I can't think of any of them that haven't violated all the Ten Commandments multiple times. And look what they're doing with killing civilians in Ukraine without even permitting them a safe exit. Is that Christian?
Hardly. So that brings us to Ukraine. Herman, we're, of course, as you say, witnessing the greatest land war on the European continent since Adolf Hitler strode the earth, a man who, as you indicated, Putin not only apparently admired in terms of his use of power, certainly his acquisition of it, but is emulating. And that includes, it seems, with respect to the brutal repression of people who disagree with him domestically as well as externally. How did we get to this moment, as you see it, given that Putin has all of these proclivities?
Well, by giving him the notion that he could grab for free, as he grabbed Crimea. You had the Budapest Accord in 1994, where Russia, the UK, the US, and a couple other states that joined later, guaranteed the territorial integrity of Ukraine, guaranteed not to attack it if Ukraine would give up nuclear weapons. Well, when Putin made his first move against Ukraine in Crimea, he did it through these little green men. Those were special forces people with uniforms that were green but no ID. Why? Because he wasn't sure how the West would react. Had there been a reaction, he had deniability and he could have backed off, but there wasn't. And it whet his appetite. There's a Russian slogan, the appetite's increased by the eating. And I think that talks about Putin. When he saw he could grab that, he wanted to grab more.
And just a clarification. So we're often told those little green men are mercenaries, the Wagner Group or whatever they call them. Is that just a subterfuge by Putin?
Yeah, they're 100% under Putin's control.
So we saw him get away with murder in the case of Crimea. He moved against the Donbass with more of these kinds of operations, some plausible deniability. As with, again, Hitler in the Sudetenland, for example, he got away with it. And it whet his appetite for more. Was this then, as you see it, mostly a function of not only his appetites, as you put it, but also the weakness displayed by the West under, successive administrations, I guess you might say?
Well, yeah. He always had the aspirations. The law they used to annex Crimea, which happened in 94, 95, that period, was passed in 2001. The plans were in place, and they just waited for the opportunity to do so. So it's important to remember it had nothing to do with Maidan, had nothing to do with all the other things they claimed. It had to do with what they viewed was an opportunity when there was this organization in Kiev after Yanukovych was ousted. They chose to move, but the contingency plans were in place for a very, very long
and
time.
And the plans for invading Ukraine have obviously been in place for a very long time as well. Let me ask you about this woman, Victoria Nuland, who is much in the news these days. I was told that it had been actually reported that back in October, she had been dispatched to Moscow in her role as the Undersecretary of State for Policy and had conveyed to the Kremlin something reminiscent of Ambassador April Glaspie's notorious, we have no interest in inter-Arab disputes, which set the stage for Saddam Hussein's calculation that he could invade Kuwait with impunity. What's the story on that, Herman? Does that sound right or not?
Well, I don't know. I've heard the same rumors you have, but I get no independent confirmation. But at some point, we know for sure that Putin thought he could get away with it cheap. Now, part of that may be that he has lost sense of reality. When Beto Smith, former top intel guy to Eisenhower and first CIA director, was ambassador of Soviet Union 47 to 50, he wrote about it, and his biggest fear was they'd believe their own propaganda. And it could be that all the money they were spending to prepare the ground in Ukraine was spent by people that put a lot in their own pocket, and they reported back to Putin's aides, you're going to have an easy road of it, and they reported that back to Putin. So that might, in part, account for the miscalculation. But for whatever reason, he got it wrong.
So we've seen him invade Ukraine. We've seen some of the same techniques that you described he used in Chechnya being applied here, mass destruction of the physical infrastructure of Ukraine, and a lot of loss of life along the trail, including civilian life. And yet, he has not accomplished the mission as of yet. What's your assessment at the moment of where things stand tactically in terms of accomplishing the presumed goal of actually taking the whole place?
Well, the Ukrainian people, and I include ethnic Russians and Russian speakers, which are by a large majority fighting with Kiev against Moscow, are resolved not to come under the Russian yoke again. They have bitter memories of mass killings and repressions, and we're talking about killings in the 30s of millions of people, starving them to death. They are going to resist. Even if there is military control, Russian occupying force will be bled. And the more you have an occupying force there that understands that Ukraine was not a Nazi state, a preposterous assertion, that they launched a war against a peaceful people, the occupation will become more and more difficult, and I think will ultimately lead to Putin's fall.
Before we get to that, Herman, that's obviously critically important here. Let me just ask you about Ukraine. You've spent a lot of time there. Many, including some prominent conservatives, have asserted that because Ukraine is such a corrupt place, it's not really a democracy, and it's really not worthy of our support. What's your response?
My response is that people doing that have not spent a lot of time saying that, have not spent a lot of time in Ukraine. Or if they went to Ukraine once or twice, they talked to Russian proxies, because there's the only people that would spin that line. It absolutely is a democracy. You have a vibrant political debate. Is there corruption? Yes. Is there as much corruption as there is in Russia? Absolutely not. When I hear this argument, I say, you know, corruption goes in many places. How many Illinois governors are currently in jail? You know, we have it here,
we
too.
We do, indeed. And you know,
it's a vibrant democracy, and political freedoms and economic freedoms are one of the reasons people are fighting. Even if they risk their lives, they want a better life for their children, and that's a Western way of life.
Which has brought about this whole issue, according to Putin's information operations, namely that they wanted a better life. They wanted to be part of the West. They want to be part of NATO. That can't happen because that brings NATO to the doorstep of Mother Russia. And, you know, for legitimate strategic reasons, Putin is dead set against that. Of course, there are NATO countries that abut Russian Federation now, elsewhere, the Baltic states, Poland, Romania. What is your sense of that as the rationale for what's been done here? And what should be the appropriate U.S. response to it?
Russia and Putin are not threatened by NATO military power. They're threatened by the ideas of democracy that exist in NATO countries. In conversations I've had over the years with Russian generals, when we hear the line, "You shouldn't threaten us by NATO, we can't have this threat on our doorstep," I say, "Can you tell me over the last decades a single minister in any NATO country that's talked about invading Russia?" Silence. Never happened. And if that did happen, the second question, well, is there capability to do that? Even if we don't consider the fact that Russia's a nuclear war, no, conventionally the West has no chance. So why do you raise it? Because we're able to make effective propaganda with Westerners that don't understand the full picture.
Have they actually acknowledged that over a couple of vodkas with you, Herbert?
Oh, yeah. You know, there was a time, especially in the 90s, when Russia was open and free and people, having not been able to speak freely, especially with foreigners, would unburden themselves. And I had, in those days, many very long conversations and frank conversations with people of all levels of Russian society. And
so, Herman, let me cut to the chase here then. What, given everything you've said about Putin, about the truth of his ambitions, about the truth about Ukraine, as you see it, the truth about, you know, the impetus behind not only this invasion, but Putin's larger ambitions, what should American policy be at the moment vis-a-vis this conflict? And how are we conducting ourselves, as you see it, relative to what it should be?
Well, if Putin succeeds in Ukraine, and he's going to gamble, because if he can't show a military victory, I think he loses power. And I think that's his main goal now, is to keep power. And he's likely to do more civilian bombings and just try to make it so horrible that Ukraine submits, which they will not do. However, should he be successful, then the appetite will be wet. And after a period of years, you're going to see pressure on the Baltic states, on Poland and other countries. So in the U.S. interest, the interest of our allies is to stop Putin now. The Ukrainians have the numbers. They're willing to fight. And we need to give them everything they need to do to fight and to stop the slaughter. There's peace in Russia if Putin stops fighting. If Ukraine stops fighting, there's no Ukraine. And they don't want that, and that's why they won't stop, and we should help them.
Okay, so a quick question then. Should that supply of material include transferring these MiG-29s from Poland to Ukraine, and a U.S., you know, direct role in that transfer?
You know, Putin respects people that fight back. He has a relationship with Turkey that is transactional. They can do some business. They fight on some quarters. They cooperate in others. Why did that happen? Because when Putin was encroaching on Turkish airspace, the plane was shot down.
He respects those Turkish drones in Ukraine, too, I suspect, don't you think?
Well, that's exactly correct. And there is some danger that if planes come in, it may ramp things up. I can't say there's no danger, but I think there's a bigger danger in not helping Ukraine to win. So I'm in favor of those planes coming to Ukraine to be flown by Ukrainian pilots, not Western pilots. These, for those that haven't followed it, are old Soviet planes that exist in places like Poland and the Czech Republic that are not in use, and Ukrainians have people that can fly them. So if those planes went to Ukraine, they would be better able to defend evacuation routes. They'd be better able to defend security at the nuclear plants. And yes, they'd be better able to attack tank convoys that are on roads because they came in at a time they can't go cross country. There's a big mud season in Ukraine and tanks can't go through it.
There's so much more to talk with you about. We are hard out of time. If I could just ask you one last quick question, which you kind of alluded to there a moment ago, which is the possibility of escalation. Putin is threatening nuclear war. Knowing him as you do, having studied him and his cohort and his circumstances, is that a credible threat, do you think?
You know, Putin is a cornered rat, but and I don't want to predict what he may do rather than lose power. If he loses power, he probably loses his life in short order. If he would give the order, even for a tactical nuke, you have to remember there's a chain of command in Russia. And Russian generals are rather sober people when it comes to nuclear war. And I think would he choose to do something like that, the order would not be executed and Putin would be out very soon. So I don't think that the use of nukes is seriously on the table as anything other than something to threaten and to aid negotiations.
Fascinating. Herman Pirchner, this is a most important conversation, and I appreciate you taking the time to have it with me. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon with updates on all of this. We didn't get anywhere near China, which we really need to talk with you about, as you've spent a lot of time studying those guys and visiting with them as well. That's for another day. Herman Pirchner, the founder and president of the American Foreign Policy Council. Thank you. Godspeed in your good work. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we will speak with Jay Richard of the Heritage Foundation.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Dr. Jay Richards. He is the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he has been researching and writing and speaking on matters of policy with regard to a whole host of issues that are not generally regarded as central to national security, which is the focus, of course, of this program, but that I believe are very much central to the nature of our society that we are trying to defend and the freedoms that we enjoy and threats thereto. His focus has been on life, marriage, religious liberty, and civil society. And I had a chance to interact with him yesterday in a meeting in which he shared with me some really, I think, vitally important work that he's doing, controversial in some circles, to be sure, but vital nonetheless, on an issue that I guess is called transgenderism now. And we're going to have Jay both explain what that is, why it has become such an incredibly topical issue at the moment, and what it means if the agenda that is being advanced is realized. So, Jay, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us, and thanks for the work you're doing.
My pleasure, Frank. Thanks for having me.
I honestly never heard of transgenderism before the past few years, I think, and maybe that's just that my focus has been elsewhere, but it does seem as though it has come out of almost nowhere and is now very much at the forefront of an awful lot of public policy, both in the sort of identity politics scheme of things, but also in terms of, society and what it will think and do and say about this subject. So again, sort of ground us in how we got here and, well, where are we for that
well,
matter?
We are on the precipice of a great cultural catastrophe, I would say, with this issue. And, for a while we were calling it transgenderism because it had to do with this idea that there's some men that think they're women or some women that think they're men, except we're now past that. We're in sort of phase three or four in which people can say that they're non-binary or gender fluid. And this is because what I really call gender ideology, it's a radical postmodern kind of anti-reality philosophy of the world, in which, when with respect to human beings, it is a denial of biological sex. So essentially a denial of mammalian biology, this obvious idea that human beings are made male and female, boy and girl, and replacing it with an idea of gender identity. And gender identity is just the supposed internal sense that people have of what their gender is. And that's how it's defined. And so notice I'm using the word gender both in the word and then in the definition, which makes it entirely circular. And that's because gender ideology doesn't want to connect gender to biological sex. It detaches itself from that. This is different from most people hear this. They think, okay, you must be talking about that tiny fraction of people who suffer from gender dysphoria. That is, they're troubled by their sex bodies, or the rare number
which,
of people.
Which is a clinical medical condition, or
it is.
That's right.
It has been, and it's something that people that struggle with this, I have nothing but compassion for them. I can't imagine what a struggle that would be. There's this, also this issue of the so-called intersex conditions, and these are just people that have disorders of sexual development. So maybe they, you know, have a chromosomal disorder, so they have ambiguous genitalia or something like that. That is a different issue, and in fact, intersex people generally don't want to be mixed up in this gender ideology stuff. What this is a radical ideology, much like critical race theory. It comes from the same intellectual patrimony of the Frankfurt School and French postmodernism, but in this case applied to the human person. And it's a civilizational crisis, I think. It's why I'm focused on it, because, you know, the cell of society is the family. The individual and his rights and responsibilities is core to the American Republic. This strikes right at the heart of that. And if this were just the weird kind of, you know, ideas of a few people, you know, we wouldn't concern ourselves with it, but it's found its way into primary school education. It's targeting kids with these ideas, telling kids there's no boys and girls. It's, of course, targeting the military, which makes it a national security issue. And it looks like it's just happened. What's happened is it's now just kind of fully come into its own, because it's now occupying the institutional commanding heights of culture across the board. But it really was, this was a 30-year intellectual march through the institutions that got us where we are.
Okay, well, several points there bear further development. And I'll come back to the military, because this is, of course, a show that is very concerned about their condition and readiness and deterrent capabilities and so on. But before we get there, that point that you've just made about critical race theory and critical gender theory, or critical theory, and the Frankfurt School and the march through the institutions is also very much of concern, I think, to me and our audience, as it really is a Marxist doctrine for taking down countries like ours, is it not? And to the extent that it is, how does the gender piece play into that? You mentioned the cell of the society being the family and so on. And you know, as the Black Lives Matter organizers have said, you know, they are interested in destroying the nuclear family. Tie all this together, if you would, because it's so important to understanding what it is we're up against here.
It is. So think of classical Marxism from Marx and Engels was really a modernist theory. I mean, they thought they were right. They thought they were appealing to science, but they had this theory of conflict. So they tried to explain everything in terms of conflict. For them, it was between the owning class and the working class, as they imagined it. So everything is defined by that conflict. Well, there are other thinkers, people like Antonio Gramsci, people that we call cultural Marxists. And the reason is that they say, well, the traditional Marxists focus just on economic relations, but we think other cultural relations are as important or even more important. That's what the Frankfurt School did. And so they said, well, they think of conflict in other terms. So for the critical race theorists, it's conflicts between whites, which is really, it's a kind of metaphysical category, and blacks, which are the oppressed and the oppressors. And in gender ideology, it's basically what society treats as normal. So heterosexuality and males who think they're males and females who think they're males. And then the oppressed are these people that have gender dysphoria. And so everything has to be restructured in order to accommodate this framework of the oppressed class. Now, so that's important to realize. They're speaking in this heavily theoretical framework. They're claiming to speak for people that have gender dysphoria, but these are activists. It's just like the Marxists who claim to be speaking for working people. They weren't. They're an intellectual vanguard. And so this is a form of cultural Marxism, but it's also refracted through postmodernism. So unlike, they don't, you know, strictly speaking, claim to be based on science. This is, it's a kind of reality. And it's ideas replacing physical reality. I can't emphasize that enough. It's a denial of our givenness as sexual beings being replaced with this kind of conceptual apparatus of gender identity, which comes in infinite variety.
This is, again, gives rise to this whole argument that there aren't two genders. There are any number of others. I've heard numbers as high as 50, I think.
Maybe it's 72 at Facebook right now. Yeah, and that, frankly, is ad hoc.
Counting.
Yeah, and counting.
And yet, again, this is one of those moments where you are reminded of Groucho Marx's line, or one of the Marx Brothers lines, I can't remember which one, that who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? I mean, there are two genders, manifestly, that's the reality, and everything else is make-believe. But in the service, and this is, I think, your main point, Jay, if I understand it correctly, this is in the service of a political agenda, a cultural transformative political agenda. And it has as its core, what? Dividing us from one another, separating us and making us more vulnerable to sort of the control mechanisms that the Marxist cultural, economic, and others have long, you know, utilized to gain and control, exercise power.
Yes, that is absolutely what this is about. I mean, I think unlike the kind of traditional Marxism of the 20th century with state socialism, I think what we're seeing emerge is a weird sort of blob convergence of certain large, multinational tech actors in particular, and governments working together in collusion. That is this, whatever you want to call this, a kind of technocracy or corporatism. That's what I think we see emerging. But it is ultimately, it's the same old Marxist goal of a cultural wrecking ball. I mean, I'm a philosopher, and so it drives me crazy to try to analyze these ideas, which really are just completely incoherent. But for them, it doesn't matter. It's like, as long as it disrupts the normal ways of being, and if they can dismantle the system that's here, they imagine that the thing that they're going to replace it with, whatever it is, will somehow be better and more equitable. But that's essentially what this is. This is a type of weird postmodern Marxism gone to seed. And unfortunately, it's going not just after our military, not just after our corporate institutions, it's going after kids, because it's so contrary to what you see with your own eyes that kids need years of catechesis in this, I think, to believe it.
Indoctrination. Yeah. Just define the term postmodern, because I'm not sure that is something that's evident to others what you mean by it.
Absolutely. So by postmodernism here, I just mean a rejection of reason and a rejection of the idea that there are universal truths, moral truths, or truths about reality, and replacing that with narratives and appeals to power. And so it's just a rejection, not just of kind of the Enlightenment trust of reason, but the traditional Judeo-Christian idea that the world is rational, that human beings are rational and can discover truths about the world. So it's really an anti-truth, anti-reality movement that was current when I was in graduate school in the 90s. It's not even so popular now in a lot of graduate schools, but it has worked its way into schools of education so that we focus on social and emotional learning rather than, you know, pursuing the truth. Those are all manifestations of postmodernism. And it really is different from 19th century Marxism. The Marxists, they thought they were defending the truth about reality when they sort of proposed their ideas. And so it requires this kind of weird translation to figure out, okay, how is this related to Marxism and then how has it changed?
You did a program the other day at the Heritage Foundation in which you drilled down on the practical effects of this cultural Marxist offshoot on individuals, their lives, their families, and I guess extrapolated from a couple of specific anecdotes to the kind of damage that this is causing to the society writ large. Could you give us the quick highlights of that?
Yeah, I basically had a panel with three moms, all of whom have had or had kids in public schools, one in Rhode Island, one in Florida, one in California, all of whom had kids that were assaulted by this gender ideology. In one case, the mom pulled her son out and her daughter out, and the school district sued her because she tried a FOIA request. In the second case in Florida, the mom found out that the school had socially transitioned her daughter, was calling her by a male name and treating her like a male behind the parents' backs. So she's suing the school district. The third, Abigail Martinez from California, her daughter was suffering from depression, got sucked into this ideology by the school. The school managed to get through the process, this gender clinic and this LGBT group managed to get custody taken away from the mom because the mom didn't want to let her have cross-sex hormones. This is a minor girl that was 16 years old. So she started getting administered these sex hormones and she committed suicide. Now, this was what she had never told her story before, but I'm telling you, Frank, there are so many stories like this of parents whose children have been assaulted by this ideology. That's, of course, the most tragic case I know of. But these three moms are willing to talk about it, but there is an army of moms and dads behind the scenes that at the moment, they're still dealing with it. They don't want to be doxxed. They don't want their kids to be ridiculed, and so they can't talk about it. And so those of us that can, we feel like, look, we've got to let people know, this sounds crazy, but you've got to trust us. This is really happening. It's happening to thousands of Americans around the country.
Well, Dr. J. Richard, this is why I wanted you on and to have a chance to expose our audience to what you have found in your research and through this kind of program. This brings us to an effort that's now being made in Florida, and I guess in Texas as well, to try to help prevent this, well, child abuse, it seems to me. Talk about those efforts and whether they are, in fact, models for the country.
I would say what happened in Florida and what's happening in Texas are really good first steps. Florida, the Senate just passed, day before yesterday, the Parental Rights in Education. Your listeners may have heard it was called the Don't Say Gay Bill. It's not. All it's about is insisting on transparency in education. So parents have the right to know what their kids are being taught in schools. And then secondly, a prohibition on teachers introducing topics having to do with sexual orientation and gender identity in K-3. So in other words, 5, 6, 7-year-olds are too young to be having sexual topics introduced to them. It's great. I think DeSantis is going to sign it. What we need is parents' rights, transparency, an insistence that we don't expose kids to things that are inappropriate to them. And then we need to focus on the standards of care. We are sterilizing kids with testosterone and even sometimes surgical interventions in the name of gender equity. This is happening all over the country. Texas is the first state that its attorney general ruled that this constitutes child abuse because kids can't consent to sterilization. They're too young to be able to make that kind of decision. And so this isn't an attack on parents. It's a gift to parents because parents are now being told by their principals, their teachers, their counselors, even by pediatricians that, well, you know, do you really need to get on board here because do you want to, you know, want a live son or a dead daughter is what they're often told. So parents are accosted with this, told this is the only way to treat gender dysphoria, which is a lie. 80 to 95% of kids that struggle with this will naturally grow out of it if they're allowed to go through puberty. Instead, we're giving kids puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones. And so Texas has said, look, we're going to deal with this. And so we will be watching probably dozens of lawsuits between Texas and the ACLU over the next few months. And different states will deal with it differently. But that's the other part of this. We've got to handle the standards of care because if all the official medical organizations say this is proper treatment, it's going to be lost and parents won't have a prayer to be able to protect their kids from this stuff.
Jay, we are out of time. I do want to again thank you for the work you're doing at the Heritage Foundation. Jay Richard is, again, the Simon Senior Research Fellow, specializing in these and related cultural and societal issues, and it's vital work. I'm sorry we didn't get to the military, but we'll have you back to discuss what this means for, well, as I said earlier, the unit cohesiveness, the readiness, the military might of our armed forces at a very dangerous time in our nation's history. But for the moment, thank you for this brief on the background and I hope, as I say, you will keep us updated on how this is developing, particularly at the states where efforts are being made to protect children from child abuse in the name of gender equity. Jay, we'll talk with you soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In a world in which tyranny is on the march from Ukraine to China to Latin America, there was an important victory for freedom yesterday. The people of South Korea rejected the presidential candidacy of a pro-North Korea, anti-America communist. Instead, they elected his conservative opponent, Yoon Suk-yeol, who has pledged to strengthen his country's alliance with the United States, rebuild its ties with Japan, and enhance its defenses against growing threats from North Korea and China. The question occurs, will the lame duck leftist President Moon Jae-in use his remaining weeks in office to redouble his policy of appeasing North Korea that has been formally repudiated by the electorate? Not only would such a gambit be at odds with popular sentiment, it could embolden tyrants in Pyongyang and Beijing to take advantage of the transition to advance their territorial ambitions. This is Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Vice President Kamala Harris has been dispatched to buck up our NATO partners on the alliance's eastern front lines. The effect is likely to be further signs of diminished confidence in the United States and slip sliding away from confrontation with Vladimir Putin's Russia over Ukraine. For example, on the eve of Harris's trip to Poland, Warsaw offered to send 28 of its old Soviet MiG-29 fighter jets to a U.S. base in Germany in exchange for more modern American ones. Washington has nixed the idea, declining to transfer the MiGs onward to Ukraine. Meanwhile, Germany has refused to end its perilous dependence on Russian energy imports, with the Ukrainians negotiating what sounds like their inevitable surrender to Putin. Expect more such fractures in NATO's united front, especially in the wake of Kamala Harris's practice of off-putting and incompetent diplomacy. This is Frank Gaffney.